Appeals Division 1 is now in session.
Thank you, folks. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. I am Judge Furuya, and to my right is Chief Judge Goss. To my left is Vice Chief Judge Howe, soon to be Chief. And we are here for oral argument in our case number CV24-0072, Rabba versus Connect et al. As you may know, we record and live stream these proceedings. So please give your name and the name of your client prior to beginning your presentation. You have a maximum of 20 minutes per side, although you're not required to use all of that time. The clocks in the podium are there for your use to keep track of your time. You are in charge of keeping track of your own time. And just for purposes of your reference, that time does include any time you wish to reserve for rebuttal. We'll try to respect any requests for rebuttal, but as questions get going, we will see. Please keep in mind that we have read the briefing, we have studied the record, and we have conferenced this case. And with that, you may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, Susan Freeman on behalf of Connect 202 Partners, LLC. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. There is no precedent for using the voluntary payment doctrine as an affirmative ground to force repayment of previously offset or recouped monies.
So, counsel, we discussed this in conference before argument. Then any legal method of self-help defeats the voluntary payment doctrine. I mean, if you realize, oh, I have overpaid and it's an ongoing contract, so I'm going to short you in the future, just as in this case, as long as you can engage in legal self-help, then the voluntary payment doctrine really doesn't mean much then.
Well, Your Honor, the voluntary payment doctrine wouldn't apply in this case of a long-term contract that specifically provides for offsets and credits against future payments when there have been overpayments to achieve the ultimate contract price, the not-to-exceed contract price, that there can be these adjustments throughout, and it provides for an audit at the end and up to 5 years thereafter to make sure that only the contract price, no more, no less, is received. Ali v. Sitz is similar to that in the sense of a long-term contract where there have been initial payments that exceed the amounts that are ultimately to be paid, and the court has said, no, voluntary payment doctrine does not preclude that.
So the contract essentially does away with the voluntary payment doctrine in this case.
I think it does, Your Honor. The voluntary payment doctrine does not apply in any event to force an affirmative repayment of amounts that have previously been recouped. The Moody case, Your Honor, says that you cannot, by direct action or by way of set-off or counterclaim, recover money. Every single case we've looked throughout have not found a single case where it was not a counterclaim or a claim to offset or to receive and retain an offset money.
So how does Woods work with that?
Because in Woods, that was precisely the counterclaim there that says we want to retain and offset and apply these monies that we have received. That's an affirmative claim or counterclaim. There have been no cases like this one where it's been used as an affirmative ground of recovery, effectively a cause of action.
You
mentioned the audit rights, I believe,
right.
Or at least referred to them. If the voluntary payment doctrine has application, does that completely eviscerate the audit rights?
I think it's the audit rights that eviscerate the voluntary payment doctrine, but it was.
Well, I mean, if we applied the voluntary payment doctrine, what happens to the audit rights?
That doesn't make sense. They would disappear effectively. You can go back and audit and recover up to 5 years later the amounts that were overpaid. I mean, the point is that they are to receive a contract price and only that. They're not entitled to keep getting more money because they have received something in the past that was made by mistake. And that's one of the other important factors, is that there was a mistake here in those overpayments.
Let's say that the facts were that it really was a voluntary payment. It was incredibly knowingly made, and they just did it. And the voluntary payment doctrine without the audit would just apply. I mean, it's just one of those cases. I'm not suggesting the facts here do that. I think mm-hmm. facts are more convoluted than that in this case. But if that was the case, couldn't that then still the voluntary payment doctrine apply? Because you knowingly did it. You didn't need an audit to identify the mistake. You just intentionally, knowingly decided to pay more than you should have. Kind of like the lease cases where they paid amounts that they knew they just didn't owe, even if there was an audit provision.
In all of those, Your Honor, there was each of the interim payments was not a progress payment against a total amount. Instead, it was like the cable contract, where there's a specific invoice, and you pay that invoice, and you're done. Here, it is a progress payment toward a final amount that can be reduced, credited, increased over time to get to the final appropriate amount. And so it really doesn't apply. We haven't found any. The cases that are dealing with this kind of a situation, I think it was G&L and McShane, and then similarly the Ali B. Sitz, they say that it doesn't apply in this circumstance, a progress payments toward a final total amount.
Isn't Woods really different in that regard, too, because it had annual amounts and it had fixed amounts and it was no more than a certain amount every year. If this had said no more than $30,000 a month and they paid $40,000, we'd be more in the Woods category.
It might be a different situation. And the Woods court specifically said there's nothing in this contract that prevents this from happening. They didn't have a provision like ours in that contract, and that was important to the court. We do have that kind of a provision here, as you would in almost all construction law cases. You know, you've got to have progress payments toward a final. This is ADOT's money.
Just starting from one standpoint, the issue of whether the contract covers it or does not is not before us. Am I wrong there?
Well, the issue as to whether the contract provides for markups on overtime is decided.
That's what the contract. We start with this. There's
correct.
No contractual entitlement to
no that. Contractual entitlement at all. So they would be getting a windfall.
It only survives, and from my review, there were two ways to do it: an equitable estoppel claim brought below, and a voluntary payment.
Correct.
Those are the only two things before us.
Correct. The waiver argument was not raised below.
Because I think some of the briefing goes into a lot of other things. It mentions abandonment, it mentions waiver, all sorts of things. But those are the two.
Those are the two pieces that were briefed below and argued and ruled upon by the trial court. There, with respect to notice or actual knowledge, the court made this decision based upon Wood. It didn't use imputed knowledge. Imputed knowledge, in any event, I would point the court to the case cited in the reply brief of U.S. v. Bank of New England, and it was one where the court did find that there was imputed knowledge because the jury had been instructed not to convict for mistaken acts or omissions, that mistake wouldn't apply, that it was only if you had an actual intentional decision that was not mistaken. And
isn't that the problem? It's a factual issue. At that point, it's a factual issue that a jury, or in possibly this case, the judge in a bench trial decides, not a summary judgment, because there are inferences and a lot of other things that go into it.
There were a lot of decisions and rulings that the court made that were actually against our client, even though our client was the non-movement, where the court took inferences that it should not have taken. That is accurate. With respect to equitable estoppel, I would again point to a case that's in the reply brief of Pueblo Santa Fe, and the court said that it was important that the evidence showed the defendant would have acted differently if it had had notice. And the critical part of the evidence was the defendant's actions upon learning of the insurer's position. And here, as the trial court found, there was no change of position on behalf of RABA once it knew about our about Connect 202's determination that Schedule B means what Schedule B says all along.
But counsel, given the scope of the audit rights, did equitable estoppel figure into that at all?
Frankly, Your Honor, I think it does not fit into that at all. It's certainly, you don't have damages, you don't have any reliance, as is shown by the fact that they did not act any differently once they actually specifically knew of our position. I think they knew it all along. But
Well, but my point is, because these are progress payments in a construction context, and the, as you said, the audit right extends 5 years out.
Right.
To the extent that there's an overpayment, the audit will recoup that, and who cares about voluntary payment or equitable estoppel under these circumstances?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. You would not have reasonable reliance in that kind of a situation under this kind of a contract, which is, as I said, common to all construction contracts.
But for the equitable estoppel, if for some reason there had been an affirmative action by Connect to say, hey, we are going to pay these even though the contract doesn't, they go forward relying on that. For example, they could have maybe hired more people so there wasn't overtime.
That's exactly what they should have done and what we anticipated.
And if that's the case, then that's what they need to show for the reliance, not just, hey, we just continued business as usual.
They did not. And to the extent that they're saying they relied on this in entering into their consort contract that did not have, that provided for the increased amount on overtime, they made that decision a week after they raised the issue just by way of a, this is something we need to talk about, and a response back of, I'll get back to you and let's talk, and then they enter into the contract. That would not be reasonable reliance either. They certainly made a decision to go forward in any event, not just relying upon
If they made a payment there, that might have been a voluntary payment of a potentially disputed claim, right?
Yes, we don't get
a VPD on that one that they had done.
Ms. Freeman,
yes.
Can we talk just a little bit and explore kind of the dimensions of full knowledge and where we come to full knowledge? The court obviously thought that it was good enough to find full knowledge given that there were multiple people at Connect that reviewed these billings and then paid them anyway, some of whom were familiar with the PSA.
Well, Your Honor, in fact, as I looked at the minute entry order, I think that's not really what the court found. It said that there were people who looked at the invoices and who could see that excess payments, that the up-tier was being applied to overtime. They didn't say, the court didn't say that those people realized that the contract forbid it.
And that's not where I'm going, because the court obviously cited Woods and it was talking about...
That's right.
It was talking about opportunity.
That's right. It relied on Woods as the opportunity to know. And frankly, Your Honor, that is contrary to 100 years of this court's jurisprudence, contrary to the restatement, contrary to every case that we've been able to find. Mistake is not a mistake of law. Some courts have said when you have a mistake of law, then that's not going to excuse you. But a mistake of fact as to whether this contract precludes this or not, precludes the application of the voluntary payment doctrine. That's the law in Arizona. That's the law under the restatement. That's the law on all the cases that were cited here. It's only a few cases where the court said you've got a mistake of law as to what the law is. Everybody's presumed to know the law. So that's not enough. But you cannot have, you had enough information to decide when you did make a mistake. And as the court said, this was a building mistake. May I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal? Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Schaefer.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Robert Schaefer on behalf of the appellee and cross-appellant, Robba Kistner.
Counsel, I'm going to try to hijack your argument, but can you focus in on the voluntary payment doctrine and how that works with the audit rights?
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start. The discussion that happened for the last 15 minutes or so uses this term audit rights as if it's some well-known concept. And all you have to do is look at the contract, and the contract somehow says you can recoup back payments that are voluntarily made. There's nothing in this contract that says that. There's one provision in this contract that allows, and I'll quote it for you. This is from the Index of Record 483 at paragraph 114. It says the PSA allowed CO2 to, quote, make partial or provisional payment on an invoice in dispute pending audit and total reconciliation of the total charge. That is the only provision that deals with the audit provision. The audit provision simply allows CO2 or ADOT, and if you accept the flow-down argument, it allows CO2 to, for 5 years, audit Robba's costs. This is not a case where the allegation was Robba billed costs that it didn't incur. This is a case where Robba billed invoices that on their face showed exactly how the overtime was, the multiplier was being applied to overtime.
The whole part that you just quoted. Company will not be obligated to pay for invoice items not fully supported by approved progress measurements. It doesn't say that they can't, that's the only, or that they can't identify other problems, like not billing for something that's not covered. It's got to be items not fully supported by approved progress measurements. So I'm not sure how you take that to say that now audit means nothing, because I'm not sure what you think audit means if they can't do.
But that provision does not support their argument. It just says that it has to be supported.
It's also not in the audit section.
Well, it says it has to be supported. Well, the audit section is in 24.1 of Part 3.
But it doesn't say that they have to pay everything else. It doesn't say the company will be obligated to pay for invoice items unless not fully, because that's how you're wanting us to read it.
I don't think so. I think in order for the audit provision to trump the voluntary payment doctrine, it would have to explicitly say.
Well, no, you want it to trump this provision. You want this provision to trump the audit. You want us to read this to say that they can't use recoupment in an audit.
Well, the provision that I just quoted says that payments can be made provisionally in dispute. In other words, you can make a payment, but you say it's in dispute, then you can come back later and recoup that payment.
So you can only use the audit provision to back check costs that you already know are suspect.
No, what I'm saying is if a charge is made and that charge is not fully, if the full facts that would allow CO2 to analyze that charge are not in front of C202 at the time, it can make that payment and then do the audit. Okay. But here, all the facts that C202 needed in order to assess whether the invoices were being calculated correctly were set forth in the invoices. There weren't any additional facts that C202 needed.
But let's tease this language. The company reserves the right to make partial provisional payment under the circumstances. And they did that. When they identified the mistake. Let me finish the question. There's the difference of the clawback versus the withheld.
Correct.
So the withheld amount, they use this. Do you dispute that?
No, I do not dispute that to the withheld amount.
But what is there about the fact that they reserve the right to not pay a disputed amount? Let's say that wasn't there and they withheld. I could see your argument that they couldn't withhold. But why does that mean that they then can't claw back when they made it, when they paid something over that?
But
this is, they're two different they're two different tools, and you're trying to put them in the same box.
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not following your argument.
This is simply reserving the right to make a partial payment when they identify a problem.
So if CO2 says we're not sure this payment is due, we're going to go ahead and make it, but it's in dispute. Okay.
No, it says we're not going to make it.
They can also make a partial. It cannot make the payment, and it can say it's being disputed. We would have to continue performing under the contract, and we'd have to raise a dispute. But they didn't do that.
But it doesn't say if the company makes a payment without reserving the right to make a partial or provisional payment, they're out of luck.
But it doesn't say the opposite either. That's our point. It doesn't say the opposite. It doesn't explicitly trump the voluntary payment doctrine.
Does it need to?
But then
absolutely it needs to, because the argument is that the voluntary payment doctrine is a common law doctrine that parties can contract around. The question is, did the parties contract around it in this case? And the answer is there would need to be language in the contract that explicitly says that. It says that you can make a knowing and voluntary payment of an amount, and you can come back later and recoup it, even if you had all the facts.
I don't disagree with you, counsel, that you can, that given where you're coming from, what you're telling us is that parties can contract and say, the voluntary payment doctrine is hereby waived. And then it's a non-issue. I don't think anyone disputes that. I think what we're asking about here is how, when you have an audit right, and the audit right is impinged by an application of the voluntary payment doctrine, does that not eviscerate something that the parties did bargain for? I mean, it's clear to me that if Connect had done an audit and found it, in other words, that full knowledge was absolutely there and indisputable, then obviously, even notwithstanding the audit provision, the VPD would apply, or it could apply, because it's not expressly waived there. That's where your argument is going. But here you have at least the allegation that there wasn't full knowledge, and I understand we'll go there.
I'll get into that.
Right, but for purposes of this argument, what we're saying here is that, okay, well, if there isn't full knowledge, then how can you say that the audit provision, that the VPD can eviscerate a contracted right to audit? Because doesn't it become worthless if you can just find out information and do nothing about it?
I think the best answer I can give you is that if a contracting party has full knowledge, okay, if the voluntary payment doctrine applies, right, and yet there's nothing in the contract that explicitly says, okay, you can go ahead and make that payment and come back later and get it back.
Back up.
That's the issue.
Okay. I'm not making myself clear, and that's my fault. Let us assume that there is not full knowledge.
Okay.
Okay. Does the VPD deprive the audit provision? Does it foil the audit provision?
No, not in that situation, because it only applies when there's full knowledge. That's when the audit provision has its effect, is when it, if a subcontractor sends an invoice to the contractor, okay, and the contractor doesn't have full knowledge of that charge but pays it anyway, it can come back later and dispute that charge. But if it has full knowledge and it makes the payment, it can't come back later and try to take that money back.
So as long as the bill is readable.
As long as the bill provides full knowledge of how it's charged. If you get a credit card bill and you have a credit card charge on your bill, you know you're being billed for that charge. You may not remember making that charge. You may not know if your wife made that charge. But if you pay that charge, you cannot later say, well, I thought my wife made that charge. That's the Spivey case out of the Seventh Circuit, where retired Justice O'Connor said, you could have asked your wife at the time before you paid the bill. And it's the same thing here.
So they have to, under your argument, audit every bill to make sure that everything in that bill is actually covered by the contract, or the voluntary payment doctrine is going to make them pay it.
That's exactly what the Prompt Pay Act requires. It requires contractors, when they receive an invoice, to inspect that invoice and to pay it within 7 days or to raise a dispute. They can pay it and say they're paying it under dispute. They can do that.
So only if you dispute the payment will you pay in full or partial. The argument, as I understand it, is the audit provision only applies to disputed charges. If you pay,
no, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay, so even if you don't dispute it when you pay it, then you still audit it.
If you don't have full knowledge of the facts and you don't dispute it and you pay it, you can still come back later and challenge it because the voluntary payment doctrine doesn't apply where you don't have full knowledge of
it. So let's get into full knowledge.
Let's get into that.
Because I'm not sure how I get to, even with undisputed facts, that there aren't inferences that can be drawn, and when inferences can be drawn, I'm just going to walk through it. As a judge, I drew them in favor of the non-moving party. How do we not at least say this? There is enough of a factual issue that this just needs to go to a trial, whether bench or jury?
Well, I think there's two answers to that. One is that you have to make sure you properly understand what full knowledge of the fact means under the voluntary payment doctrine, okay, and what a mistake means under the voluntary payment doctrine. Because while negligence alone is not an excuse, okay, if someone gives you a bill and you know what you're being charged for, you know how they've calculated it, you can go look at your contract and determine whether that's a valid bill or not. If you just pay it without choosing to investigate, that's not a mistake. You have an obligation under the voluntary payment doctrine.
Do you have a case that says you
Absolutely.
Have a duty to investigate the payment and make sure? I mean, that's a pretty
well, yeah,
broad
if you
statement.
Look, yeah, I can read you lots of quotes from the comments to the restatement. Conscious ignorance. This is comment E to section 6 of the restatement. A claimant may also assume the risk of a potentially invalidating mistake by a unilateral decision to act in conscious ignorance of relevant circumstances. Okay?
So any bill they don't check, if they don't go through it completely, because that's a conscious decision,
if
saying they're stuck.
What I'm saying is if the invoice is plain on its face, what's being charged and why it's being charged, how it was calculated, a contractor cannot simply sit back and say, well, I'm going to pay all these invoices and I'll figure it out later.
So I
That's not how the Prompt Pay Act works.
So as long as your client put it on the bill, no matter how wrongful it was to have it there, if they didn't catch it, they're stuck paying for it.
It has to, well, the equities can still be weighed. It has to be a good faith demand for payment.
Okay.
And here there was a good faith.
Faith in that. Isn't that a fact issue? Whether these
Absolutely
bills
not.
Made in good fact?
Absolutely not.
How is a good faith of the person billing not a fact issue?
Because in this particular situation, we gave them notice that Schedule B was incorrect. They didn't object. Before we billed any overtime, we met with CPO2.
Your client was wrong on that.
Well, we chose not to appeal the issue.
Your client
issue.
Was wrong.
No,
under the
I don't.
Law, as we sit here today, your client was wrong.
No, my client was misled into agreeing to a switched Chart B.
Your client signed a contract that does not provide
Absolutely. At the time,
that
at
has,
the moment
so that
of the contract.
That is the fact.
But that doesn't, that only looks at a snapshot in time, Judge.
But then your client.
You still have to look at the conduct of the parties after the contract was introduced.
It sounds like a lot of fact issues for the trier of fact to decide whether it was good faith for your client to even send the bill. And that's part of what I'm looking at the restatement 6-2, and it
There's
says,
no
look, you can't just ignore the other side and how they were acting.
Yeah, it may be, ultimately there may be issues of fact concerning aspects of this case on equitable estoppel. But I don't think that there are any issues of fact on voluntary payment, because there's no dispute here that we made this charge with the good faith belief that we were entitled to charge it. We met with someone from CO2 before we submitted the invoices. We asked them, Is it okay if we submit it this way?
It sounds like a great argument, counsel, but I could disagree. I think reasonable minds could disagree whether or not that was good faith. I mean, that's the problem. You're saying that as a matter of law, there's not a person who's reasonable who could say, I'm not sure that that's true because you knew they didn't do it. You knew what it looks like to include it because you've seen it where you include it and you build it anyway. Well, I could make a good argument as a lawyer that I'm not sure it was good faith.
Well, I think that in this situation, under these circumstances, it's a close call.
What do you do with a close call?
Well, I know, but I would make a very strong argument that there are three undisputed facts here that show why the court should not remand for a trial. Number one, we sent them a notice in writing, in an email, of our position. They did not object. That's an undisputed fact.
It's also undisputed that there was no written modification, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And you knew it wasn't in there. So you thought there was a mistake and it was never corrected.
So the first fact is that we sent them a notice that it was a mistake and it was not objected to. We followed that up.
No, it wasn't corrected to. Let's make sure we include it all.
But I'm getting to that. Secondarily, we followed up. We asked someone who was in charge of making sure we billed correctly, Mr. Penton. We told him, we showed him the weekly timesheet detail on how we were going to calculate our invoices. We said, is this right? He said, yes, that's right. Then this is the critical fact, they paid for 2 years without a written modification.
Equitable estoppel looks at whether the first seven or eight months you didn't bill that. So it wasn't until later on, even in the process.
If they were watching it
for 3 months and it didn't happen, and then all of a sudden.
No, we sent the email on August the 3rd. We met with Penton on September 22nd. We sent our first bill on September 26th. They paid the bill on October, I think, 7th.
And that bill included overtime.
That bill included overtime.
Okay. Your brief mentioned that there are multiple dealings between RAVA and Connect, or the principles
yes.
of Connect,
yes.
not Connect, and that those other deals included provisions such as your client wanted to include. That was in your brief.
Well, the main language in Section 1.24.4 was exactly the same or substantially the same as on all six previous deals.
But the schedule is different.
The only difference was that the schedule was changed by Mr. Lewis very late in the negotiation.
That's the only difference. My point here is that there was a course of dealing that would suggest that this was the intent of your clients, but that's not on appeal right now. What is on appeal is that we have here a course of dealing about whether or not there's a fact issue on full knowledge, meaning that your client was giving invoices that were inconsistent with the contract and your position is that there should be an imputation of institutional knowledge such that because there was opportunity to see it,
I don't think that's quite our argument. That's a fallback argument.
Okay, and here's my point. My point is, doesn't that key to us exactly that the nature of the fact issue, because there's this other course of dealing where these same employees are getting invoices from RABA that are allowed to charge the overtime, and yet on this project they're not. Doesn't that form a reasonable fact question?
You mean as to whether they had full knowledge of the facts?
Right.
Well, the invoices themselves on their face provided the knowledge.
I mean, that's...
You can't consciously ignore documents.
And that's my point, is that we're saying here that...
They may not have known the contract rights, but parties are... Constructive knowledge applies to your contract rights. That's the Henry Cortez case. We have five employees here that know how
to do it. One counsel, because Schedule B is part of your client's contract.
So if they're bound to that knowledge and they're acting inconsistently with it, and then we're going to impute that to them, now we're back to...
Parties can waive written contracts orally.
But doesn't that call into question your client's good faith in billing on a contract that expressly didn't include it?
It only raises the question of your good faith if you conclude that it's not enough for good faith to provide written notice, to follow it up with an in-person interview, and to accept the fact that the other side knows how you're billing and they pay for 2 years. If that's not good faith...
No reasonable mind could reach...
I think no reasonable mind could say that there's a lack of good faith.
Okay.
Yeah, under those circumstances. I see I've only got about 10 seconds left, so rather than trying to accomplish much else, I will thank you for the court's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Ms. Freeman.
Susan Freeman again on behalf of Connect 202 Partners. With respect to the 3 points that they say are not evidencing good faith, number one, notice was sent in writing. If the court looks at that notice, it is an emailed, this is kind of what we just discussed, and get back to me. Look at it. It is not noticed. It was not sent to Walter White, who was the person who was required to actually get any formal notice. It was not a notice. Number two, the disputed fact about whether a conversation between Penton and White occurred, that is where the inferences were made against my client, the non-movement. Mr. Penton does not recall that conversation, doesn't think that it happened, but in any event, Mr. White, the robber person, says that it did occur, and he remembers saying that this transaction, the billing, was like the horseshoe billings that the parties, that one of the components of C202 previously had with RABA. And that was misleading. It was not like horseshoe where they did have a markup of the overtime. So number three.
Ms. Freeman, just a thought. If Connect's billing personnel, the ones who did see these, were dealing regularly with these invoices, thought this is like the horseshoe deal, and not like Connect, is that a mistake of fact or is that a mistake of law because they're misconstruing the contract?
It's a mistake of fact, Your Honor, and it's very similar to the other mistake of fact cases. And if you look at the restatement, I think it was the comment E that we quoted at length, it says, be careful in these kinds of commercial transactions to even try to impute mistakes to impute knowledge. It just doesn't happen appropriately in a large commercial context, and that's what we have here.
It's paradoxical.
It is
the word they use.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Number three was that we paid for 2 years without a written modification. The contract required a written modification, a change order, and they knew that, and these are very experienced people, and they didn't enter into a written modification.
But you're not disputing that contracts can be varied by conduct, are you?
You know, as a general principle, you can have partial performance of a contract, but that's not in a situation where you have a contract like this that specifically requires it. You do have a prompt pay act that requires the payments be made promptly, and there's a specific, I think it was a Stone Creek case after that, that says that the parties reserve the right to make all kinds of civil and civil actions to follow up. The parties retain all of their rights, even if they make those payments.
And wouldn't the more appropriate analysis be that the argument seems to be, and it's mentioned, that in fact Connect abandoned that provision and was paying the overtime, but they didn't preserve that argument, did they?
And there is no preserved argument with respect to abandonment.
And that's what it would require. And there's no preserved requirement of modification.
There is no, that's correct, Your Honor. Course of dealing between C202 and RABA, there is no course of dealing. There may have been other deals between one of the three component participants in Connect 202, but there was no previous course of dealing, and it certainly does not override the written contract. With respect to a duty to investigate, there is no duty to investigate. When you receive a contract, when you receive an invoice, you do have the retained right under this contract to go back, and if you figure out that they had been overbilled, and we think it was deliberately overbilled in this case, that we can go back and correct that and deal with it and make reductions if the You know, they made a representation about paving in some area and they didn't. You know, you can go back and correct that. It may have been all in good faith, but you still have the right under this contract to correct it.
There was a suggestion that if you don't audit and identify the issue in the payment under the Prompt Pay Act, you waive it or it's gone.
And that's specifically contrary to Stone Creek.
I'm sorry?
That Stone Creek, there's a decision, I believe the name of it is Stone Creek, that's interpreting the Prompt Pay Act. We did cite it in our brief that says that that's absolutely untrue.
Well,
I
understood your colleague to say that you didn't have to dispute the invoice in
Correct.
Order for the audit.
Correct. Yes, we didn't have to dispute each one. I mean, that's the point. You figure out their mistakes. There's somebody who has overbilled. There's some amount that was improperly charged. You can go back and correct it. The sections of the contract are 24.1 and 24.1.1, plus the additional provision that the court cited. The court below was misled into thinking that none of this applied because the 24.1.1 only referred to ADOT, but there's additional briefing that follows up that shows that it is not limited to ADOT, that C202 could also audit and should go back and correct overpayments, and that reference or that position of the trial court has not been preserved and is not argued on appeal.
We've had a very interesting discussion today about the voluntary payment doctrine, but isn't your argument at bottom that whatever the contours of the doctrine are, the audit provisions of the contract obliterate in your application here?
Your Honor, that's right. The contract provides for a not to exceed dollar amount, and there are progress payments toward that. And if there's a mistake that's made in terms of an overpayment or an underpayment, that gets corrected down the line, and the contract provides, and this is common in construction contracts. It would be such a problem in all construction contracts if you had to approve each specific contract and you could never go back and correct it.
And, I mean, the facts could be different. If they had sent a cover letter with each bill that says, by the way, just so you know, we've included the overtime and that's what's in this bill, then that might factually result in a different outcome because they're telling you they're doing it, and then the question of knowing becomes kind of rises. That's why I say it seems a factual issue as to knowing. They could have really made it a knowing payment on your client's part.
Even if that were the facts, Your Honor, this would be the first and only case ever that can make you pay again a mistaken overpayment that you've already offset through credits against the payment.
Preliminary issue.
Yes. Let's see. Okay. 5 seconds left? No.
No. Thank you,
Counsel. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel, for your arguments. We will take this matter under advisement and issue our decision in due course, and the court is adjourned.